From WUWM Milwaukee Public Radio, this is Lake Effect. I'm Bonnie North. Today on the show, the continued violence in Ukraine forced a special meeting of the UN Security Council this past weekend. Our foreign policy contributor weighs in. Then we'll learn about the 19th century forerunner to big-time spectator sports, professional walking.
You really see the beginning of the modern sports industry in pedestrianism, the idea of monetizing every aspect of it from, you know, the beer concession at the venue to they had trading cards. Some of the first trading cards featured pedestrians.
The hero of Brian Kimberling's novel Snapper studies birds and the people of Indiana.
The book is something like a collection of specimens of Hoosier humanity, something like a collection of specimens of birds.
And essayist Joel Habish imagines a scenario in which corporations really are people. Lake Effect comes your way next. First, the news. This is Lake Effect from Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Bonnie North. Thanks so much for tuning in. The shaky interim government in Ukraine continues to grapple with the violence caused by the Russian separatist movement in the eastern part of the country. Over the weekend, the UN Security Council met in an emergency session with envoys from both Russia and Ukraine, but the future of that part of the world is still very much up in the air. Art Sear is Lake Effect's foreign policy contributor, and he talked with Mitch Tyke about whether the violence is being drummed up by Russia or is an organic phenomenon.
I think it's both, from what I know. I have no information beyond what's in open news sources, let me emphasize. But clearly, Moscow and President Vladimir Putin are making mischief. It's complicated for all kinds of reasons, including history. Joseph Stalin, one of Putin's predecessors, and another challenging leader, to put it mildly, of the old Soviet Union, Stalin very self-consciously moved masses of people. Out of Ukraine as well as other areas, including Georgia, and moved lots of ethnic Russians into those areas to dampen down the kind of dangerous nationalism that continues to bubble, whether there's a Cold War or not.
Is there a parallel to be drawn with many, I don't know, African nations here when it comes to the definition of Ukraine's borders? I mean, was there something artificial and doomed to failure in Ukraine the way it was drawn after the fall of the Soviet Union?
No, I don't think so. I think the borders have been continued. It's a very good question. I haven't really thought about that. But my immediate answer is there were lots of predictions in the early 60s, especially after Harold Macmillan, in his Winds of Change speech, the great British Prime Minister announced that, in effect, the British Empire was coming to an end and it was time to face reality. Colonial powers, the British, the French, the Dutch, and other mostly European colonial powers arbitrarily drew national boundaries in Africa across tribal lines. Those boundaries have held, even though, as we're all aware, ethnic violence has been sporadic, at times horrific, including currently in parts of Africa. I believe that the national boundaries, while murky compared to Western Europe, do represent basic ethnic divisions in southeastern and eastern Europe generally. That doesn't make it easier to manage these situations, but it is a different context than Africa.
Well, and so in this case, the ethnic divisions in Ukraine exist only because the Soviet Union put so many Russian nationals in that area to begin with.
That's right, although there are divisions within these countries as well. That's a very important point as I understand the history.
By confronting the separatists, which is what the government of Ukraine is attempting to do right now and issuing ultimatums, does the government also force the West's hand to some extent?
I think that's right. Acting President Turchynov is a guy who clearly deserves some sympathy. He's trying to do the right thing. I don't think he has a personal agenda. It takes some courage to take this job in the circumstances. He's also suggested a UN occupation force, which I think is a very good idea. He's declared adamantly that Ukraine will not be paying any more of Russia's natural gas bills. Ukraine owes Moscow about $2.2 billion. And an argument against Russia seizing all of Ukraine is if they take over this very troubled country, they're never going to get paid. He announced a firm deadline by which the separatists have to be out of these government buildings. As of now, there's no indication that the military, Ukraine's military, has moved after the 9 a.m. deadline. I think he's trying to do different things to maintain stability, and I think he's to be commended for what is a kind of dangerous public service.
How big a leveraging, a bargaining chip is $2 billion? I mean, it's a lot of money, but it is not an enormous part of Russia's GDP.
Russia's GDP is almost a state secret. Since the end of the Cold War, the collapse of the Russian economy has been predicted. It hasn't occurred, but it is a very weak economy and very much dependent on natural resources, foreign investment, and the black market. So
$2 billion could be a fairly substantial bargain.
That's right. It also reflects much larger leverage that other countries, especially Germany, which has about one-third of its external gas and oil, I believe, coming from Russia and related territories, and the United States, which is incredibly becoming we're a gasoline exporter now. We're rapidly becoming a global exporter after being heavily dependent since the 60s. So I think energy is right to focus on as a source of strategic leverage.
The UN Security Council has taken up this issue on an emergency basis, and obviously, as you say, the situation concerns much of Europe. What's the likelihood that the UN might choose to occupy, if you will, Ukraine, or certainly send a force there to try to keep the peace?
I think we should promote that. I think that's very desirable if we can achieve that. And I think it would be a stronger deterrent to Russia sending troops in directly. There's a big difference between sending the Russian army explicitly in and having these men, heavily armed, well-trained special forces types without insignia, clearly Russian in nature, in first Crimea, now Ukraine.
Well, and so presumably this is something that would give Russian forces some legitimacy versus being seen as an occupying force?
If they were part of a designated peacekeeping force, but I think that's a very imaginative point. It does open things up for a possible stabilizing force. The UN during the Balkan Wars of the 90s tried to fulfill that role. Unfortunately, it was ineffective, and finally NATO and the U.S. intervened. But we didn't have the Russian army so directly involved.
Well, you mentioned energy policy. I wonder what the implications – I mean, obviously, this issue isn't taking place on our border, but how do you see the situation impacting U.S. energy policy?
Well, there's a tremendous move in Congress spearheaded by Republicans in the House to facilitate export of natural gas. Principal petroleum and natural gas companies in the United States want to do this. The potential for – at least short-term disruption in prices in the U.S. is one reason why perhaps we shouldn't move too quickly. But I think we'll see this increasingly discussed in the media.
How do you see this situation playing out in an election year in the United States? Is there any natural fault line to be found from a partisan standpoint?
Well, yes, there is. The Republicans are already engaging in election year politics by blaming President Obama and the administration for this crisis. I do think that's unfair, even though I believe the president badly mishandled the Syrian crisis and civil war, and things aren't related. I do think the Republicans are already trying to get election mileage out of this. There is a fissure within conservative ranks. You find people like Senator Rand Paul, Pat Buchanan, who is not as visible as he once was as a candidate, but is very powerful in sectors of the right and the Republican Party and very influential and a very smart person. I don't agree with him, but I do think it's good that he's around. They're arguing very strongly, in effect, that this is in Russia's interests and we should be tolerant of this move. Republican conservatives can't make up their minds whether they want to be interventionists, a la the George W. Bush crowd and neoconservatives, or they want to be, in effect, libertarians or even isolationists, a la the Republican personalities I just mentioned. I think that will, is a very practical problem, limit and restrict any Republican hay that might be made out of this problem in the 2014 elections.
It is an election year, and while defense policy doesn't always cause people to vote one way and not another, there is a case where all politics is local comes into play, and that is the Obama administration's new proposals for military downsizing. What's your take on this idea for more base closures and otherwise shrinking the size of the armed forces?
I think it's essential, given the financial realities in Washington and in the United States, given the substantial and increasing debt levels, even though the fiscal deficits are coming down with the economic recovery, that we restrain federal spending, entitlements, and also defense. The fact that we're reducing forces to a lower level than we've had in approximately a half a century, I think in many ways reflects reality. One of the positive developments of the Vietnam War was Congress passing legislation still on the books that if any war becomes sizable or has a long duration, we mobilize the National Guard and Reserve, something that we didn't do during Vietnam. And this should be kept in mind when the Wall Street Journal and other sources trumpet about the weakness connected with reducing defense spending. The administration has not taken a sledgehammer or a meat cleaver approach. It seems like more a scalpel approach to reductions. And the base closures that Secretary of Defense Hagel is proposing, I think, and the president, reflect some considerable political courage, given the fact that they're a very powerful political pork barrel in this country historically. I'm a great admirer of Chuck Hagel. He's a combat veteran of the Vietnam War. He knows about not only the military in a theoretical or administrative sense, but in terms of the realities of war and the realities of what line troops face. And I think that should be kept in mind when he's subjected to strong and, I'm sure, growing criticism as the election approaches.
There have been base closures that have taken place in past years and a lot of proposals for base closures to take place that have been essentially headed off at the last moment. Is there any more likelihood that this administration will be able to follow through with these plans than any previous plans?
I don't know, but I do think they deserve credit for demonstrating this kind of courage. I think the changing constellation of American politics, military bases tend to be concentrated still in the South, and the newer generation of mostly Republicans, certainly committee chairmen in the House at the moment, the Republicans who now dominate the old Confederacy, seem on balance to have less staying power and certainly less power, especially when they're in charge of committees, than the old-fashioned Southern Democrats who guaranteed continuing massive military spending from the beginning of the Cold War on bases mostly in the South.
So you're saying this is more of an open question today than it would have been 10 years ago?
Yes. Although Secretary of Defense Robert Gates, I don't particularly admire his tell-all memoirs, but I do admire his tenure. He was able to get fairly substantial closings, including a kind of comprehensive multi-service, relatively new base in Virginia. He was able to get it shut down in the face of enormous criticism from the congressional delegation in Virginia.
Before we wrap up, we should make one more reference to the still missing Malaysian jetliner that's believed to have gone down someplace in the South Pacific. The latest news we've heard is that the international effort to find this jet is now going to employ submersible vehicles. Is it possible in this day and age, 21st century, the 21st century world, could the world ever accept not knowing what happened to this thing?
Apparently not. I think eventually we will find it because the Australian Prime Minister and the Australian military and others who are involved, including our people, indicate not only off the record but on the record that they're confident it'll be found, probably not right away. What's more interesting is our obsession with this, even though there's been no real news. The media, especially TV, have to focus on it relentlessly. It shows how important international travel has become. Air travel, which used to be very much an elite, very limited activity into, say, the last three decades, has become a much more mass activity. And we also want answers. I was, by coincidence, having lunch with good friend, a gentleman in his mid-90s who was a B-29. He wasn't a pilot. He was a flight engineer and survived the war. it's valuable to talk to him about it. He mentioned in talking about Flight 370 that even planes that survived Japanese fighters during that terrible time, we would lose planes coming back. Even though they had radio contact, they would simply disappear from the flight formation and were never found, and that was part of life. We don't live that way anymore. It's a testament to our technology, but it's also a testament to our immaturity in a way that we have to have answers, especially Americans, I think, today. We have to have answers, and it's good to have a sense of history and a sense of fatalism.
Art Sear, thanks so much.
Thank you, Mitch.
Lake Effect contributor Art Sear is Clausen Professor of Political Economy and World Business and the director of the Clausen Center for World Business at Carthage College in Kenosha. Many of us walk for fitness or even just for pleasure. Coming up next, we'll learn about a time in the United States when walking was something we watched others do, sometimes for days. Walking as spectator sport comes your way when Lake Effect returns on Milwaukee Public Radio. It's Lake Effect on Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Bonnie North. The Milwaukee Brewers drew more than 3 million fans to Miller Park a couple of years ago as they made their most recent playoff appearance. The numbers have dropped off a little in more recent times, but baseball is still a popular ticket through the summer here and around the country. But turn back the clock to the 19th century, and the hottest ticket in town, well, as far as sports were concerned, was the sport of pedestrianism. Watching people walk around a track, often for days at a time. It's a sport that is almost entirely forgotten today, or at least it would be forgotten if not for a new book by writer Matthew Algio. It's called Pedestrianism: When Watching People Walk Was America's Favorite Spectator Sport. In an interview recorded at Boswell Book Company, Algio explained to Lake Effect's Mitch Tyke what spectator sports were like in this country before pedestrianism came along.
There really weren't spectator sports in the United States before the Civil War. The population of the country was pretty widely dispersed. It was a primarily agrarian culture. It wasn't until after the Civil War, you have the Second Industrial Revolution, people begin moving into the cities, mass migration into the cities, and accompanying this are the construction of the first large public buildings. And these are the things that made spectator sports possible in the decades after the Civil War. The problem is there really wasn't much to do in the United States in the way of entertainment in the 1870s and 1880s. Most of the entertainment at that time was still geared toward the wealthy. And so a ticket to a play or a musical might cost a dollar or two when the average worker was lucky to make a dollar a day. And pedestrianism, as boring as it sounds to us today, to watch, really filled a void in the United States, especially in the 1870s, by giving people something to do.
What was the confluence of events besides the fact that the Second Industrial Revolution happened? People had extra spending money, but what happened to get people behind the idea of walking?
It really goes back to a guy named Edward Weston, and he was a door-to-door book salesman from Providence, Rhode Island. And in 1860, he made a bet with a friend on the outcome of the 1860 presidential election. Weston bet his friend that Lincoln would lose. Lincoln wins, of course. Weston loses the bet. And the terms of the bet were that the loser had to walk from Boston to Washington in 10 days and make it in time to see Lincoln's inauguration. And so Weston set out on February 21st, 1861, and began walking from Boston to Washington. And this really generated a lot of attention, a lot of excitement even in the country. People were really captivated by this, the idea that somebody would try to walk from Boston to Washington in 10 days in the middle of winter, terrible roads. Everybody had experience with walking long distances at that time. And so I think people really empathized with Weston. He arrived actually 4 hours late. He missed the inauguration. But he gained such fame from this walk that after the Civil War, he began staging walking exhibitions. He'd go to a town, and roller rinks actually were springing up everywhere. Roller skating was very popular at the time. So he'd get to town, and he'd rent out a roller rink, and he'd attempt to walk, say, 100 miles in 24 hours. And people would come by the thousands just to watch him walk in circles to see if he could cover this 100 miles in 24 hours. People paid about 10 cents to watch this. And especially in smaller towns, there was really not much else to do. And so Weston gained quite a lot of fame and also made a lot of money and also attracted a lot of competitors. people came up and said, well, I can walk 100 miles in 23 hours or 22. And eventually this kind of mutated or evolved into the six-day walking matches that that really were the most popular form of the sport.
Well, so talk about what these events were like. Six-day walking matches were the most popular version of this. What would happen when you went to one of these things?
Well, first of all, you'd have usually the large arena in the city. In New York, it was Madison Square Garden. In Chicago, there was a building called the Expo, where the Art Institute stands now. But you would mark out a dirt track on the floor. It would usually be about a seventh or an eighth of a mile around. And the competitors would begin walking just after midnight, Sunday night, Monday morning. Of course, at that time, there were blue laws that prohibited any public amusements on the Sabbath. You couldn't do anything on Sunday.
This is why these are six-day matches.
Exactly. That's as long as they could be. And so they begin right after midnight, Sunday night, Monday morning, and then the competitors, the pedestrians, would go off. There were a team of judges that kept track of how many laps each competitor made, and they would continue walking as long as they could, as much as they could, right up until the following Saturday night at midnight. And whoever walked the farthest was the winner. I mean, the rules were pretty simple. But there were other things there, too. I mean, you had, there would be brass bands playing music. Celebrities would stop by. You might see Tom Thumb at one of the big walking matches in New York City. So people went not just to watch people walk, but also for the spectacle of the event. And I like to say, football games can be pretty boring, but there's a lot to see at a football game besides the football. And so that was one of the attractions of the sport.
And presumably watching people walk at the beginning of a six-day race was significantly different than what the spectacle was like 3 and 4 and 5 and 6 days
right.
into this.
Right. The hottest ticket was for day six, because not only was that when the outcome would be decided, but also when the competitors were most bedraggled, dehydrated, sleep deprived. They were just staggering around the track. I mean, I say it was like watching a NASCAR race in super slow motion. And part of the excitement of NASCAR is going to see the crashes. And this was the equivalent. This is when you would see the crashes would be on day 5 or 6. I mean, these guys would be so wiped out by then that it's really amazing that they were able to compete at all sometimes for 6 days.
This is almost the 19th century equivalent of an extreme sport.
Yeah, very extreme. They would be on the track, upwards of 21 out of 24 hours a day. Usually they would sleep. They would usually have small cots, or they would even have small tents for them on the inside of the oval where they could sleep and also relieve themselves. But generally they'd be on the track about 21 hours a day, sleeping in, 15 to 30 minute increments throughout the day. I go into the book in, I'm sure, excruciating detail about sleep patterns. But one of the things that these guys did is they slept by sleeping, several times throughout the day. Most of us are monophasic sleepers. We just sleep once. And some are biphasic, where you sleep twice. Well, these guys, the best, I think, were polyphasic, where people can sleep several times throughout the day for 45 minutes or so. And this is what, if you go, these guys who do a solo around the world boat races, they generally just sleep in small increments throughout the day.
Right. You're right. There's also like a subculture of pedestrianism where people would walk a mile every hour for as many consecutive hours as they could, and they would sleep basically from the moment they finished to the last
right.
possible moment they could walk the next mile.
There was a guy in 1809, Captain Barclay was his name, a Scottish guy, and he walked 1 mile every hour for 1,000 consecutive hours to win a bet, which is, I think, 40-some days. And then, of course, somebody had to walk a half mile every half hour for 1,000 consecutive half hours. And then there was a woman, Ada Anderson, who took it to its ridiculous extreme by walking a quarter mile every 15 minutes for 1,015 minutes or whatever it was. So she got absolutely no sleep at all for 28 days. I mean, every 15 minutes she would walk a quarter mile. But that was one of the exhibitions that really attracted people's attention as well, these kinds of preposterous endurance events.
Well, and speaking of attention, this was a sport that was covered in the newspapers and magazines. What kind of reputation did pedestrianism have?
It had a mixed reputation, actually. The pedestrians were really the first celebrity athletes. They got endorsement deals. Some of them wore their sponsors on their shirt. So you're seeing the beginning of the corporate sports culture. They were really heroes, especially to a generation of young men and women who would imitate them. You hear about kids going out and imitating the walk of their favorite pedestrian, the way somebody might imitate their favorite baseball player's batting stance, right? But as pedestrianism got more popular with the public, it also became more popular with gamblers, and it had the influence and the association with gambling, also with alcohol. They would sell so much alcohol at these events. And, of course, the temperance movement was very much alive at that time. And so the temperance movement kind of advocated against pedestrianism. They thought it was basically unholy. And so you see kind of a backlash. There's an anti-pedestrianism movement in the country, if you can believe that.
And if I remember correctly from the book, a couple of Wisconsin newspapers were kind of trumpeting the cause of anti-pedestrianism.
Yeah, and I don't know why, but I saw some of the most virulent anti-pedestrian editorials were in Wisconsin papers. I have no idea why this is. Maybe somebody here has – do you have something against walking in Wisconsin? I don't know what it is exactly. But yeah, there were two Wisconsin papers that editorialized against pedestrianism. But they were really just an example. There were papers everywhere that thought it was – and they also thought it was kind of ghoulish in a way. That you were, by watching these people put themselves through these exertions and really pushing themselves to the, brink of mental and physical collapse, that there was something, exploitative?
Exploitative. Right.
Yeah, about it. And that was another reason that people campaigned against it.
One of the other things that struck me, though, as we think back recently, we celebrated the anniversary of the integration of baseball, and that happened in 1947. Pedestrianism integrated 75 years before baseball.
Right. There were a number of famous black pedestrians. The most famous was a guy named Frank Hart. He was actually an immigrant from Haiti, moved to Boston, and on a lark entered a six-day race and won it, and so began entering more prestigious competitions and eventually won a couple very prestigious races. Pedestrianism really was a very democratic sport. I mean, if you were able to walk far in 6 days, you could compete on a level playing field, really. And so it opened doors for not only African Americans, but for Irish Americans and German Americans as well. It was a way to, much as sports are perceived this way today, it was a way to advance yourself, a way to make money, and a way to prove your worth.
Women did this too.
Yeah. Women pedestrians took part in six-day races. The women pedestrians had a major disadvantage, though, because the mores, would you say, of the time dictated that women covered, you couldn't show your calves. So the women all had to race wearing full-length, often very heavy velvet dresses and gowns. And so while the women competed and the races were very popular, they were at a decided disadvantage when it came to participating as opposed to the men who were able to wear tights and shorts.
So this booms fairly quickly, it seems, and the future seems very bright for pedestrianism. It ended almost as abruptly as it came up. What led to the end of pedestrianism, and why did the end come so quickly?
A couple of things. One, public confidence in the sport was really shaken by the association with gambling. There were gamblers that colluded with some of the lesser pedestrians to help fix races. There was also a doping scandal. One of the pedestrians was caught chewing coca leaves while he competed. And this also sort of hurt the perception, the public perception of pedestrianism. But the biggest thing that really killed pedestrianism in the end was the invention of the safety bicycle in 1885. An Englishman named Starley invented the bicycle. Before then, the bicycles were those kind that had the big front wheel and the tiny little back wheel, the penny farthing, and they were hard to race. They weren't very nimble. But the safety bicycle that Starley invented, which he named the Rover, incidentally, and then later made cars under that name, and the Land Rover and the Range Rover, kind of descendants of the safety bicycle. The safety bicycle was really nimble. It was quick, and you could race bicycles now easily. And, of course, watching a bicycle race, which also held the promise of crashes, was much more exciting than watching the pedestrians walk around in circles for 6 days. So really, the six-day bicycle races kind of replaced the six-day walking matches almost overnight.
How hard was it to find information about the sport? How much evidence is still out there? I mean, for example, you look at the book, and it it only has drawings of walking matches.
Yeah, we don't have any photographs that I've been able to find, unfortunately. Most of my research came, well, there were several different sources. The best was contemporaneous newspaper reports. We talked about how there wasn't much else to do. Well, one thing there was that you could do was read newspapers, and there were lots of newspapers back then. I mean, I forget, New York City might have had 30 daily newspapers at the time. And so it was a very popular sport, and it was covered in the popular press, and so there are lots of newspaper accounts of it. And also, I was able to go back and find some old programs. New York Historical Society has some of the old programs from the races, and that had a lot of biographical information about different competitors. And a couple of the major competitors, Edward West and Daniel O'Leary, they were actually the subjects of biographies, and so there was primary source material there as well.
You mentioned Madison Square Garden. That's obviously the Madison Square Garden that was first
right.
In
that was the Madison Square Garden that was actually at Madison Square.
There are not any, to our knowledge, there are not any arenas still standing today that hosted pedestrian
actually,
matches.
Actually, there is the Royal Agricultural Hall in London is the one place where it was built, I think, in the 1860s, and it was abandoned in the 1960s, but it was saved from demolition, and it's now a convention center. So I was able to go to the Royal Agricultural Hall, the Aggie. It's now the Business Design Center. And that's the one place where the great walking matches were held that is still in existence.
Let's talk about America's other favorite pastime. What was baseball going through at the time pedestrianism was coming and going?
The National League was founded in 1876, right at about the time that pedestrianism is becoming popular. The National League, though, in the early years was very, very disorganized affair. Teams came and went. Some teams, if they were losing and out of the pennant race at the end of the season, would just quit and not play the rest of the games. I think at least one team got kicked out of the National League the first year. But by the 1880s, the owners got together and decided, well, we really need to organize this thing. They did a couple of things. They imposed a salary cap of $2,500. And they also introduced the reserve clause, which was a notorious clause that bound a player to his team in perpetuity, basically. There was no, they ended free agency. And so this really stabilized baseball. But by 1890, there are 8 teams in the National League, and 7 of them are still around. Only the Cleveland Spiders are no longer with us. The other 7 teams in the National League still exist. The franchises have moved around, of course, a lot, but you can trace them right back to that time. And so by 1890, baseball had really become a viable enterprise, and a lot of the people who had watched the walking matches and the bicycle races had moved on to baseball as their favorite pastime.
There is a sport that's an Olympic sport, speed walking.
Right.
How does that modern sport compare to pedestrianism? And are there other parallels that exist today that we ought to draw?
Modern race walking, I guess, is the direct descendant of pedestrianism. I think the Olympics has 10,000 and 30,000 meter race walks.
And it is back and forth on the same track.
Yeah, they just go around in a circle. It's about as interesting as you would expect to watch. And I've watched a few. It's interesting. In modern race walking, of course, you have to keep one foot on the ground at all time, but as perceived by the human eye. So it's possible when you look at it really slow motion that they do have 2 feet off the ground sometimes. And this was a very controversial point in pedestrianism in the 1870s, 1880s. What does walking mean? How do you judge that sort of thing? So, yeah, I would say race walking is the kind of the direct descendant of pedestrianism. But really all the modern spectator sports, I think, in some way are descendants of pedestrianism. I mean, as I said earlier, you really see the beginning of the modern sports industry in pedestrianism, corporate sponsorship. Guys are, you know, spokesmen and spokeswomen for different products. The idea of monetizing every aspect of it, from you know, the beer concession at the venue to
there were trading cards.
Yeah, they had trading cards. Some of the first trading cards featured pedestrians, and so really, it is kind of the birth of the modern American sports culture in this really brief but interesting period of time.
What made it so compelling to you?
Well, I needed to find an idea for a book, and my editor said yes. I was researching a book called Last Team Standing that I wrote about the 1943 merger of the Steelers and the Eagles. The NFL is so short of players during World War II. I'm getting a plug in here that they had to merge the Steelers and the Eagles, and they became the Steagles for a season, and the quarterback has a perforated eardrum, and the center's deaf in one ear, and the wide receiver's blind in one eye. And it was while I was researching that book that I began looking at the history of spectator sports in the United States. And that was the first time I had learned about pedestrianism, and it really just struck me as a kind of an offbeat, but in its own way, important little piece of American history, especially American sports history.
Well, Matthew Algio, thank you so much.
Thank you, Mitch.
Matthew Algio is author of Pedestrianism: When Watching People Walk Was America's Favorite Spectator Sport, published by Chicago Review Press. He spoke with Lake Effect's Mitch Tyke in front of a live audience at Boswell Book Company in Milwaukee. Coming up next, Indiana is a contradictory place in real life and in the world of Brian Kimmerling's novel, Snapper. We'll hear about it after a break on Lake Effect from WUWM. Lake Effect returns now. I'm Bonnie North. Thanks for joining us. Before he was a writer living in England, Brian Kimmerling was a professional bird watcher in his home state of Indiana. And as he was being paid to study the behavior of the birds in the field, he also came to think about the behavior of his fellow Hoosiers. Both of those experiences come out in his wry and observational novel called Snapper, which relates to the formative experiences in the early adulthood of protagonist Nathan Lochmuller, a fictional professional bird watcher in southern Indiana. The book is just out in paperback. Talking with Mitch Tyke last year, Kimmerling talked about who first encouraged him to write about Indiana.
Well, the person in question is Tessa Hadley, novelist and New Yorker regular. And when I described certain things that I had done in Indiana as a delinquent adolescent, she found Indiana sounded very romantic. It was this romantically desolate place forsaken by commerce and industry where kids could build fires on the railroad tracks safely. And that romantic view of Indiana really stuck with me, partly because it's correct. It's really hard to maintain it when you're soaking in reality in Indiana. But viewed from England, it made for a good story.
Is it correct now or is it correct in your memory?
It's correct in my memory. It's still correct in reality in certain lights and moods, but anywhere you live is going to stop seeming romantic fairly quickly.
Well, right. It's a point that comes out in sharp relief late in the book, but without wanting to give too much away. Would you say, is it a universal that we are all both hypercritical of the place that we are from and at the same time staunch defenders of it?
I don't know if it's universal. I think that Indiana in particular has a kind of, well, Hoosiers have a kind of identity complex. Mitch Daniels, after he was reelected, called it the Hoosier inferiority complex. So I think Hoosiers can be more defensive and more critical than Kentuckians. I have no idea about Wisconsin.
but for people who have only ever driven the Indiana Toll Road and this is their sole exposure to the state, we should have you describe the Indiana where Nathan Lochmuller is from. This is not an industrial part of the state.
He and I both come from Evansville, which last month was ranked number 8 on a list of the 10 most miserable cities in America, according to a Gallup poll. A few years ago, it had the highest per capita obesity, according to a Gallup poll. I suspect someone at Gallup is from Evansville and filled with self-loathing, like so many people from southern Indiana are, and that has deep roots.
Well, and it's also, you know, it's also highly rural. I mean, Evansville is a large city, and Bloomington is also in this part of the state, but it seems to be a place of some contradiction. There is this natural beauty that also exists there.
Yeah, I did want to highlight the pristine woodland and abundant wildlife in the book because that is one of the distinguishing features of Indiana, especially southern Indiana. I don't know northern Indiana. I think it's flat and that's about all I can say. But that is a prominent feature of the book because it's a prominent feature of the landscape.
And, of course, Nathan, as you were once, is a professional bird watcher. Why is southern Indiana so significant in the bird world?
Audubon lived across the river in Henderson, Kentucky. So it is Audubon country, judging from the sorts of birds he would have seen. And moreover, Thomas Say, the father of American entomology, who described 1,400 new species more than any individual before him, lived in New Harmony near Evansville. His wife, Lucy Sister Say, was the first woman admitted to the American Academy of Natural Sciences in Philadelphia. That's a lot of science, a lot of early science documenting the new world in southern Indiana. It's not very well known, but it's a distinguished history.
Well, and so can you talk about the role that Nathan plays and the role that you once play? Nathan is not the biologist that draws the conclusions necessarily, as a courtroom scene in the midst of this book makes abundantly clear. So where does he fall in the study of these birds?
Well, he accidentally gets a job collecting the data that a real ornithologist will analyze some other time. And it's much more romantic than being a real ornithologist spending all day in a database.
Well, and so this is this fairly close to the role that you actually did in the field before you turned to fiction?
I was a research assistant for a major study of songbirds for 2 years organized by Indiana University. There were 30 or 40 people doing it every year. If you looked around Bloomington now, you'd find people doing that job. But I'm the first one to make a book out of it, I think.
Were you... In your mind, were the birds first? Was Indiana first? Where did Snapper originate in your mind?
Indiana was first, and I come back to that notion of romantic Indiana again. In Bloomington, when I arrived, there was this huge derelict furniture factory in the middle of town, and there was a big tower in it. And, of course, it was fenced off, and there was no trespassing signs everywhere, but you could get in. You could climb this tower 30, 40 feet up in the air, sit on top with a six-pack of beer, and watch the sun go down. That was very romantic Indiana. That factory is now City Hall. It's been renovated and dolled up, and the tower's been torn down. So that's a big part of my memory and my identity, and I have conflicting feelings about it, especially because the City Hall is very nice.
Well, and what about conflicting feelings towards the people of Indiana? I mean, that's a real issue for Nathan. You know, he has these friends and he has, you know, his group of relatives, and there seem to be contradictions within all of these relationships about whether he loves them or loathes them, if you will.
I think most or all of the characters are some aspect of Indiana incarnate, and again, it was Indiana that inspired it more than any other thing. It's not an easy place to live. I mean, really hot summers, really cold winters, for example, and a lot of monster truck rallies, like gun and knife shows. And I Evansville, number 8 in the miserable cities list, also has, you know, a very good Philharmonic Orchestra, and a lot of good people live there, and they struggle.
Well, and moreover, I think there's this aspect to Indiana that probably most people outside Indiana don't give a lot of thought to, which is how closely, both geographically and philosophically in some ways, it is to kind of the Old South.
Yeah, especially southern Indiana. Peter Taylor, the Tennessee short story writer, is a great hero of mine. He used to say there's nobody more patriotic or tribalistic than the people right on the edges of a given area. So nobody's more southern than Kentuckians. And that is not quite the case for Evansville, but it's part of what happens in southern Indiana. By the time you get to Bloomington, you're not really in the South anymore.
Well, and I think there's the scene fairly early in the book where Nathan is really relating his aunt and uncle who have moved to southern Indiana from Texas, and Texas, by all accounts, is in the South, and it's really kind of the South to an exponentially higher degree that they find themselves in.
Yeah. In that passage, there's something about southern cultural cohesion and the way the South does evolve and change. Indiana, because it's kind of on its own, disowned by most Midwestern neighboring states, doesn't change, and old prejudices linger.
So how do you see the people that populate the Indiana of this book and the Indiana that you know dealing with each other as relating to how Nathan sees the birds on his watch? Because that's the thing that he's studying to a large degree is how these birds are interacting with the world around them.
One of the premises of the book is that there are good people everywhere, And the other premise is they can never get along because a bunch of them are in prison. You know, there's a couple running a truck stop, and I was sure in my mind that they were Sarah Palin fans, and they don't really get along, and they never will, but it doesn't make them bad people. The book is something like a collection of specimens of Hoosier humanity, something like a collection of specimens of birds, and I think that's reflected on the cover.
Well, and not that this would ever necessarily enter into the creative process, but did it give you any concern how the book might be received in Indiana?
Oh, yeah. I just gave some readings there, and I thought they might turn into burnings. But it was received very enthusiastically. I think people are just happy that Indiana has been written about at all. And moreover, I don't think that Nathan's jabs at Indiana are ever as – he pulls some punches, and he's very affectionate toward the state in the end.
Well, and as someone who is from there, you have a certain amount of latitude in being able to throw those punches or pull those punches that someone from somewhere else wouldn't have.
Yeah, I'm not going to write the same book about Milwaukee. I'd be getting real trouble.
You wrote recently an op-ed for the New York Times on what comes out of bird watching, sort of where it fits in today and historically. I'm hoping you could illuminate it a little bit for us because this seems like one of the sort of great pieces of citizen science that still goes on today, that even the people who aren't being paid to be out there in the field collecting data are participating in some way, and you are not doing it professionally anymore, but I would imagine once you know of birds, you always know of birds.
I was surprised with citizen science when I looked into it because I thought the data would be rather unreliable. But they've had a few years to work on it, and some projects like the Audubon Christmas Bird Count, that backs up reams of peer-reviewed research now. With the proliferation of mobile technology, some more dodgy data proliferates too. But it's a new and important development that actually we can crowdsource data collection. And I think that makes the act of going out and watching birds more worthwhile because it's not just your personal gratification. You are doing a service.
So this is a kind of minor point in the book, but I feel compelled to ask it anyway. Are fried bagels really that good?
It's not a question of quality. It's a good hangover medicine. you need grease when you're hungover.
And you should share the recipe here.
Yeah, you put a whole stick of butter in the skillet, and then you put the bagel face down. The outer shell of the bagel is essentially impermeable, but the butter soaks into the inner soft bit and just becomes a wonderful delivery mechanism for grease.
Was it at all odd writing this book from – I mean, you wrote this overseas.
I did, and I think that was essential. As I said, I kept this romantic view of Indiana in mind even while the narrator is disparaging it ruthlessly. And the clash between that vision and that style of writing is a big part of the book. If I had been in Indiana, particularly in Evansville, I would have been pretty itchy. And I don't think I would have written the same thing.
Well, I'm glad you wrote the thing that you did. Brian Kimberling, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Brian Kimberling is the author of the novel Snapper, which has just come out in paperback. He'll talk about the book at Boswell Books tomorrow night as part of a World Book Night commemoration and Thursday night at Books & Company in Economowoc. He spoke with Mitch Tyke last year as the hardcover edition was released. What if corporations really were people? Lake Effect essayist Joel Habish has an idea, and we'll share it next when Lake Effect returns on WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio. We're back with more of Lake Effect on Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Bonnie North. The 2010 Citizens United ruling by the Supreme Court held that corporations hold the same free speech rights as everyone else in the context of political campaign donations. Or, as Mitt Romney apocryphally put it, corporations are people too. With that in mind, Lake Effect essayist Joel Habish imagined a hypothetical conversation.
Mom, Dad, I've got something to tell you.
Must be important to drag us down here. You need more lights, Larry.
Well, maybe not for long, Mom.
Our 30-year-old son is moving out of our basement?
Yes, Dad, but that's not the important part. I found someone I want to marry. You see, there was this court decision.
Frank, he's gay.
Son, does he have his own place?
I'm not gay, but I will be moving out, Dad. I'm sorry, Mom. I know you're going to miss me so much.
I'll get over it. When can you leave?
Wait, Celia. So what's the problem with this court decision, son?
Well, actually, that's the thing. There is no problem. Not anymore. You see, the Supreme Court has ruled that corporations are persons.
So?
So I'm in love with one, and I want to marry her.
See, Celia, you had to let him go to that progressive summer camp when he's 16. He's been off ever since.
Quiet, Frank. Larry, this corporation, is she nice? She's just not interested in you for your money.
If he had money, would he be living in our basement?
Mom, I admit, I've spent a lot on her.
I knew it.
But she's already sent me some super dividends.
That's nice. How well do you know her?
You're making me blush, Mom, but I've already seen her operation.
Celia, stop asking him so many questions. Who is she, son? Sara Lee, Mary Kay, Estee Lauder, ConAgra?
ConAgra?
Well, they give girls funny names nowadays.
Wait, Frank. Larry, is it Fannie Mae?
Mom, I don't even know if Fannie Mae is strictly a corporation. I mean person.
I say she is, and she works for the government. That's a nice, steady job. Or there are plenty of fine catches out there. Marie Callender, Betty Crocker, Mrs. Butterworth, all very domestic, too.
Listen to yourself, Celia. They're way too old for any son of mine. Say, Larry, did you ever go out with some of those foreign bodies?
Well, I had a fling with Stella Artois. I made the scene with St. Pauli girl for a while, but I found I really liked Americans better.
That's my boy. Hey, Larry, how about that Ruby Tuesday? She's a beauty.
Quiet, Frank. Now, dear, you know that you're in for the long haul, and you'll have to take the good with the bad. Companies have their faults along with their good points, and now that they're persons, apparently they also have their feelings, so you can't treat them as if they're unfeeling corporations anymore.
I know that, Mom. I met her in the markets, and as you can imagine, these last few years, our relationship has been very volatile, to say the least. She even threatened to move offshore for a while. But I love her, and our bond is mutual.
Have you been true to her?
Well, Dad, I was tempted to stray a couple of times. You know, you hang around the barbershop, and you hear tips about some hot companies, and you're tempted to take a flyer.
Boys will be boys.
Shut up, Frank. Larry, have you met the family? Does she come from common stock?
With me, she's preferred all the way. She's the result of a very friendly merger and has a respectable parent corporation, as well as some delightful sister companies.
Is she a closely held corporation?
She is when I'm around. And, Dad, I'll introduce you two to my gal soon enough. But there is a problem.
A rival, huh? A hostile takeover?
No, nothing like that. And even if she ever splits, she'll still be loyal to me. She calls me her precious little shareholder. But, well, there's the possibility of a little company in the offing, and I don't know if we're quite ready.
A moral dilemma, eh?
Yes, Dan. We can't agree on whether a startup becomes a person when its stock issues are first blessed by the SEC, or...
Or when?
Or when it gets its seed money. So, Mom and Dad, I was hoping...
Lake Effect essayist Joel Habish is a freelance copywriter who lives in West Allis. He's past president of Working Writers of Wisconsin and worked for years at ad agencies in Milwaukee and Chicago. We'd also like to thank Gina Dragutinovich and Lake Effect's Craig Wuerl for their acting talents. And I'm Bonnie North. Thanks, as always, for tuning in today. We're looking forward to having you join us again tomorrow and every weekday morning at 10 for Lake Effect from listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio, NPR in Milwaukee. Stay tuned. Fresh air comes your way next. It's 11 o'clock.